Welcome back to the DFS Office Hours Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan, and this episode is a recording of an interview originally streamed live on YouTube on November 4th, 2021, with two NHL DFS experts from the SaberSim community, DFS Couch and Mr. Clean. We discuss the high-level strategies needed to beat NHL DFS, how to use SaberSim's tools to build a strong portfolio of hockey DFS lineups, and the best ways to add value to SaberSim's NHL DFS tools. These interview-style shows will be published every year for the start of new sports seasons and occasionally outside of that to help break things up, so I hope you enjoy.
All right, what is up, everybody? Welcome back to another day of SaberSim's strategy sessions. Super excited about this one here today. We are going to be talking about what it takes to beat NHL DFS in 2021. And if you have watched some of our other streams and my office hours here, you know that I am not the expert about hockey DFS. So I went out and pulled a couple guys who are. You may recognize Scott, aka Mr. Clean here, and Sam, aka OX Couch, from our winner's circle or from the Slack community. A couple guys here that know a little bit more about hockey DFS than I do. But Scott and Sam, how are you guys? Thanks for being on the stream today.
I'm great, and you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Right on. Cool. I don't want to take up too much time here. We got a lot to talk about. Want to just start diving in and talking a little bit of hockey strategy. But before we jump in, I always want to mention that we do these shows live for a reason. If you have questions about anything we're talking about, how to build better NHL DFS lineups, pop them into either the YouTube chat or the Office Hours channel in Slack. I know there are a bunch of questions already in the queue here today, so we will get to everything. But those are the best two places to ask your questions. And again, if you're confused by something you're saying, you have your two cents you want to add to the conversation, please do. That's why we do these shows live. So I'm going to go ahead and just jump us right in and just start talking about what it takes to be successful here in NHL DFS. So I'm going to ask you guys, you know, we talk a lot on stream here about upside, building lineups for upside, whether it's NBA, NFL, and we always characterize these, you know, traits of upside in a lineup with our sliders, right? Correlation, ownership, variance. What does upside look like in NHL DFS, especially maybe for somebody that's a little bit more familiar with some other sports or familiar with these ideas of upside? How do we think about building lineups with upside in hockey?
Yeah, from my standpoint, Jordan, you have to build with a strong level of correlation in mind. And you've probably heard this a lot, like, duh, Scott, hockey's correlated. But the lines in NHL, so like the first line that the player skates on or the first power play line, are so tightly correlated to one another. Like the example I like to use is like take Austin Matthews from Toronto tonight. He's got on his line, John Tavares is on his first power play line with him, Nylander on the even strength line with him. They are about as correlated to one another positively as a hitter is negatively to the opposing pitcher in baseball. You would never play a hitter against the opposing pitcher except on like a two-game slate, right? In hockey, you're losing so much potential upside by ignoring the fact that, you know, like Matthews and Nylander and Tavares are super correlated to one another. And you can actually go look in SaberSim and see this, that as you go further down the lines, the correlation almost drops to zero for players on other lines between like Matthews and somebody else. Like, you really need to focus on those tight groupings of players who are going to play and score together if you want to succeed and have really high upside lineups. That's number one, like above all else to me.
And also, just to like add on to that, in other sports, you can set like stacking rules because you think, you know, I really like the Braves, so I want at least four Braves in every single lineup. In NHL, it's a little bit different because, you know, like Scott was saying, players on different lines are not even that closely correlated. There is a little bit, but like not much. And so using one of the new stacking features in SaberSim is at least from the same line. Mm-hmm. Is one of the more important features, I think, because that's how you're going to get a lot of the correlation and a lot of the upside.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, I mean, again, coming from this from a standpoint of a total NHL newbie, what's happening on the ice that leads to these players skating on the same line to being so highly correlated? What happens over the course of a game that creates that correlation? And why are players not on the same line? Why is that correlation so much lower?
Sure. So the starting lineup for any individual team is basically four lines of skaters. So four sets of three skaters, right? And the top line and the second line are typically the ones that get the most ice time. And then the third line slightly below them. And then the fourth line is kind of like a checking line that gives everybody else a break. And I would say fourth liners are probably the ones you can usually like safely exclude, except on the smallest of slates or like a showdown or something like that. But those three skaters, the center, the wings from that first line or from that second line, are almost always skating together. So their time on ice is also heavily correlated to one another. It's not a total like one-to-one correlation. Like sometimes someone won't get a shift, so you get like one mismatched player, or a coach may make a decision mid-game to swap a couple players, you know, because things aren't working well. But generally speaking, you could look at like line one for Toronto. You know, you look at Austin Matthews, like I said, and Nylander. They're almost always going to be on the ice together when they're on the ice. So when Matthews is scoring, the chances are that the assists on that goal are going to come from someone else on that line or a defenseman who is skating with them at that time. But the likelihood of one of the assists or the activities that are going on in any given play are almost always going to be those same players participating in those same actions together. That's really what it is. They're almost always skating with one another.
Gotcha. Cool. And so you mentioned, you know, the centers and wings in particular. Do the defensemen fit into those correlations well, or?
So most teams have three sets of defensemen. There's three pairs, basically, two each. And they kind of follow similar patterns where the top defensive line will get the most ice time, the second one will get the second most ice time, and then the third one gets the third least. Now, the third defensive line, I think, is a lot more viable than the fourth skater line for plenty of reasons. First of all, they still get, you know, somewhere in the vicinity of 16 to 20 minutes of ice time per game. A lot of the third pairing defensemen are also on the power play because they may be good shooters and just not particularly good defensemen. So there's a lot more value in the third one. We can get into value later on in terms of value plays, but they don't quite correlate one-to-one. So the first defensive pairing isn't always on the ice with the first this first skater line, but they are following from like a time on ice perspective. You know, kind of similar patterns to that. The other thing to keep in mind is that those defensemen from the first and second pairings often skate on the power play lines. So there'll be one from the, you know, first defensive pairing on the first power play line, which means, again, if you look at, you know, let's just take someone like Alex Pietrangelo from Vegas as an example. Thank you for pulling it up for me. We'll take a look at him, and you see here his correlation. He's correlated to Jonathan Marchessault, Chandler Stephenson, Dadonov. These are all first line power play skaters for Vegas, and he's on the power play as well. So his correlation with these guys is pretty strong. Now, one thing about defensemen, though, if you go down the line here, he still has a moderate level of correlation with some of the other players because his time on ice isn't naturally as strongly correlated to like the first line skaters as all of those skaters from the first line are. But he's still, you know, he's still got this strong correlation between these other guys who are also on that first power play line. So when you're looking at defensemen, if you're not going for straight value from a defenseman, right? You're not trying to like plug in a cheap defenseman just to fill out your lineup. These are some guys to really look at because they're going to be on ice with the scorers. They're the ones who are either going to generate some goals because they're getting great feeds or getting assists or just taking a lot of shots because they're on the ice a lot.
Gotcha. Cool. And while we have this pulled up here, I think go ahead. But maybe for people that are a little less familiar with SaberSim overall, our approach to building lineups and projecting players is a little bit different than what you might have seen before on a traditional optimizer. We simulate out all of these games play by play, and maybe has a little bit of a more abstract meaning for something like hockey. But we simulate out these games here thousands of times, and that allows us to determine the full range of outcomes and correlations of these players. So what you're actually seeing here, we've got pulled up, is you're seeing the range of outcomes, and we'll talk about that here in a bit, but also the correlations from this player to every other player on the team here in our simulation. So really powerful data overall. I want to also talk here a little bit about, unless you've got something that you wanted to add on here with correlation.
No, I was just pulling up a couple other, like so Austin Matthews is a first line forward. We use a center. We talked about him before. Mm-hmm. So you just see here that like it's, you know, some of these guys will be 0.3, 0.31 correlated with other skaters on their line, depending on kind of time on ice and things like that. So there's a very strong correlation, like I said, between him and some of the other skaters from that line. That's all I was going to show. Like, this is what we're talking about. But you get down the list, and he's almost not at all correlated to other skaters on the team. Like, there are players from Tampa Bay that he is more highly correlated with than players from his own team, basically.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. And so on the, from the lens of ownership, I want to talk about that next. That's our second slider, our second kind of characteristic of upside here. For a sport like hockey, where does the chalk tend to condense on a slate? Especially, you know, you're sitting down and looking at the ownership projections. What are you looking for when you're trying to identify where the chalkiest plays are going to be?
Sam, you want to grab this one? I feel like I've been talking a lot.
Yeah, I mean, so I think in NHL especially, it follows like a lot of other sports, but the chalk is always going to be on the highest game total games, mm-hmm. especially on those favorites. But one thing that you'll notice in hockey is that like the chalk is always really heavy chalk. Like the last few nights, even last night was like a pretty small slate, and there were, given it was a small slate, but there were still some players that were like 60, 70% owned. But in my opinion, it wasn't small enough to deserve that kind of ownership. But I mean, if you just scroll through, you can see it's like pretty heavily condensed around the highest game totals.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I guess just a follow-up on that too. So thinking about these different lines, does the ownership then tend to kind of condense on the first line for the highest total teams first, and those second lines come in a little bit lower owned? Or is it a situation where, you know, maybe highest total team on the slate, maybe it's Toronto tonight, you're seeing that whole first line for Toronto, that whole second line, like Toronto just being a very popular team overall? Or just kind of curious, you know, almost getting ahead to thinking about some like leverage opportunities where that value shows up.
So I think dependent on salary, obviously, because salary is going to play a big part here. But if you look down this list here, What these highest projected ownership players all have in common is they all skate on the first power play line. And the field knows this. Mm-hmm. The field knows that these are the guys who are going to spend the most time on the ice and have the most opportunities to score. Like this is just straight up true, right? Like they have the most opportunities to score. Every single one of these first 25 or 30 we've looked at, and keep going down the line, these are all first power play lines. Now, not all of them are on the first even strength line. So they may skate on a different line, even strength, that they do on the power play, mm-hmm. But they're all first line power play players. And yes, to that regard, they do follow slightly. Like there's a couple of like stud superstar players, like Austin Matthews is an example here, or last night Connor McDavid was an example, who are always going to draw a ton of ownership. And honestly, this 28% for Matthews might be low, because we're always a little low on Austin Matthews. He always ends up higher than because he's just one of those stud players. Like there's three or four of them that just draw more ownership than everyone else. But yes, like John Tavares from the second, from the first power play line, he's a little bit cheaper. You can fit him in a little bit neatly. Mm-hmm. He is also pretty high up there on the ownership chart. And 13% ownership on what is tonight? It's a nine game slate. That's pretty high in a sport like hockey for an individual player, particularly like a second line player. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you do see like there's definitely a correlation to these teams and where the ownership is falling, right? Like you can just see down this list, these are all kind of the same teams that we're seeing here.
And that leads in perfectly. How good is the chalk in a sport like hockey?
Well, let's go look at Austin Matthews again real quick. So his projection here is 15 tonight, right? So mm-hmm. that fits right around in here. If you look at this, it's not actually like his plurality projection. His most common outcome is actually under 10 points.
Right.
So yes, the chalk is going to hit, and it's going to hit sometimes. And if you're not playing it, you'll be sad. It's going to happen. But there's so many outcomes in his toolbox here that say that he's not going to even hit that projection. This projection is being lifted up by these outcomes way out here, where he gets a hat trick and a couple assists to go along with it, and has 8 shots on goal and just goes crazy. I think last night there was some, who was it for Colorado that just had an insane night last night? Cole Makar, I think it was, their defenseman, he took a million shots, had a hat trick. He scored like 45 points last night. Like, that's going to happen sometimes. But the most likely outcome for him, and like all of these players, is actually something less than that. Like, they're almost always in this lower range here. It's not like a sport like, say, NBA, where we go look at like Embiid tonight. Like, he's got a nice, like a nice round bell curve, right? Where you know that his most common is here and it's going to kind of go down around that bell curve. Hockey does not work the same way at all. The projection is really artificially risen a little bit by those outcomes, where he just goes far and away beyond the projection. So in that regard, I think if you are one of those who just wants a full fade chalk, NHL is a great place to do it, because there are so many outcomes where Austin Matthews does not return anything close to $9,000 worth of value.
Right. Yeah. That range of outcomes curve looks very similar to what we see for maybe like something like baseball hitters, or maybe higher variance NFL positions, like a wide receiver or something like that. We've been talking a lot here on the Office Hour streams recently, how, with chalk in NBA, just like you pulled up with the NBA range of outcomes here a minute ago, with that much of a player's range of outcomes above their value point, their target score, I guess. It's almost the best play to be over the field on the chalkiest player on the slate. But for a sport like hockey here, I'm imagining that's often not going to be the optimal strategy here, especially for some of the more large field stuff.
Look, and I get it. Like, on a night like last night, Sam mentioned that Connor McDavid was over 60% owned on most of the contests. Like, that's scary to be at under or 0% of a player like that, right? Like, because he is the best scorer in hockey right now, like, flat out. Like, he's just skating circles around everyone. But I don't think he was even top 5 or 10 plays last night. He was fine. Like, he was good. He wasn't great last night. But that's scary, right? Like, 60% owned is scary to be under on. So if you want to go all in on a player like that, I totally get it. But it's just that you just have to recognize that you're going to end up with a lot of scenarios where he's just never going to come close to that projection, which is very different than, I think, NBA is a great example there. You're used to a player at least coming within like sniffing distance of his projection most of the time. Whereas in hockey, it's actually not the case. The projection is truly an average here of a huge range of outcomes.
I was also going to point out, like, in a sport like hockey, I put less weight in the actual projection number, and I mostly look at it as a metric of opportunity. I don't think that this sim is literally saying that Austin Matthews is going to get 15.4 fantasy points, or else, he was a bad play. I just think it's basically telling me he has the most opportunity for the most fantasy points, given all of the situations of the game environment and, everything else that the sim is factoring in.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And a lot of times for these sports where a player has a wide range of outcomes or isn't very normally distributed like we have here, the value of those average projections themselves and the value of the value column goes down when we're looking for players maybe to target, especially just, staring at a player pool for an upcoming slate. Sam, you mentioned kind of opportunity or the ability to hit these upside. Are there any like stats or anything that you guys do in your research process that might indicate to a player beyond just what their average projection is that player has upside? I'm thinking about, research maybe in a sport like NBA into usage or minutes or fantasy points per minutes, or a sport like NFL, something like their targets or air yards, some of these other stats that kind of maybe indicate that there might be upside there, even if it isn't showing isn't showing through as much in the average projection.
I mean, so for me, my research for NHL, I pretty much only do it on a team by team basis.
Okay.
Because I don't want to like overweight things that the sim is already taking into account. I think the sim is doing a pretty good job of taking in that player's skill against, you know, the opposing team's defense or, you know, all these different stats that the sim is already factoring in. But I try to look for, you know, opportunities where I think a team is maybe not given being given enough credit for a specific matchup, especially like so early in the season. I think there's a lot of opportunities to find that kind of stuff.
Gotcha. And are there teams that play faster than others? Is pace or anything like that kind of a something that you think about in NHL? Or like, I was just like legitimately curious. If the answer is no, or not something that like plays into your content or your strategy, that's totally fine.
I'll say to that point, Jordan, like actually SaberSim has historically done a pretty good job. I'm going to use Montreal the past couple of years as an example of this. Mm-hmm. They shoot a ton. Now, they're not good shots, but they shoot a ton. So especially last year and the season before, SaberSim loved the Canadians for good reason, because they just take a ton of shots. And there are some metrics out there that look at just pure volume of shots a team takes, whether they're on net or not, as an indicator of a team that has a lot of upside, right? And SaberSim already does a pretty good job with that. So I don't need to go too deep into looking at stuff like that, because I've got all that information right here in front of me in terms of what's been simulated, right? But I think that's one thing that you might look at is what teams are just like just firing on net, right? Like who is just taking a dumb amount of shots? Who's got defensemen that are just firing towards the net and trying to pick up rebounds? Because there are some teams that do just shoot more than others. Some teams look for their opportunities to take higher quality shots and play more puck possession. But then you've got, like I said, your Montreals, who just historically, they've just been firing. So I think that's one thing you might look for. Another thing is just kind of pay attention to like time on ice, particularly those players whose time on ice is ticking up a little bit more. Like this is really useful for like upper line defensemen. Cause if you get a defenseman who's playing 25, 26, 27 minutes a game, every minute he's on the ice is another opportunity for him to generate points, right? Whether that's one extra block or a couple extra shots or an assist that he picks up that he wouldn't otherwise pick up. Like you can't score anything if you're on the bench, right? If you're just waiting for your next time on ice. So time on ice does play a pretty big role in what you might look at if you're really trying to like find a diamond in the rough or somebody who might be upcoming that the rest of the field is not yet quite on, if you use somebody who's ticking up in that regard.
Gotcha. Yeah. Cool. And some good comments here coming in our YouTube chat here, but Tim echoed your thoughts here and said pace of play will likely be based on total shot quantity. Mm-hmm. Agree with Scott that SaberSim does a great job identifying this for skaters and goalies who will see high save totals. Interesting kind of note there on the other side of that we can find some goalies maybe with some upside playing against teams that are putting a lot of shots on goal.
I was wondering when we were going to start talking about goalies, because boy, do I have opinions about goalies. I'll start here, and please, Sam, jump in if you have any comments here. So many people, like I hear people talking about like building around goalies or like who's the right goalie to target. Do not ever build around a goalie. Do not target a goalie. Don't even think about goalies until you get further into your build. Here's why. Goalies are like hockey is random. Goalies are even more random than the sport itself. They are all over the place. And there's been some analysis in the past that you need like 7 to 10 seasons of a goalie to know what his or her, I don't know why I said her, his true talent level is in the NHL. Like it's insanity. And it is entire. And it's a weird position too, where a goalie's success is in part, at least based on the other team also kind of succeeding, right? Like firing a ton of shots at him, but then also not succeeding enough to score. So like he needs the other team to do well, but not too well. One of my favorite things about goalies actually in NHL is, you remember we used to have like the field that just said ceiling on here? You could look at the ceiling for each one of the goalies, and basically everyone on a slate from the goalie position had like approximately the same ceiling as every other goalie on the slate. And that's no truer statement about a goalie have I ever seen, that they basically all have about the same ceiling. It's just some of them are obviously better than others or play in front of better teams, right? Mm-hmm. And like their range of outcomes is a bit more a bit more consistent with what we expect from another sport. Like the projection is a bit closer to kind of where the peak of their bell curve is here, but they are so random on a day-to-day basis, and some of it is entirely out of their own control, right? Like if they end up facing 12 minutes on the power play, they're gonna give up some goals, and that's not even really their fault, right? It doesn't mean it's a bad goalie. So when I'm looking at goalies, the thing that I'm actually most focused on, I'll look at some of these like higher projection, like these higher ceiling projections, and mm-hmm. see who Saberson projects as a bit lower owned in that range. And those are the ones who, like, okay, I probably want more of these guys, because this is another area where the chalk is strong. And there are a ton of like really great plays that you can get at 5% or less owned. And these are the guys who they will score so many points for you that they can win you a slate if you just get the right goalie. But finding it's like a needle in a haystack, right? There's no real great way to project how a goalie's going to do, because no one can do it. If they could, these teams would all have great goalies. Sorry, I'll get off my goalie soapbox and let's
see. No, I think that's good. Something I was going to point out about goalies is on any given night, very rarely are you going to have a goalie that makes, 40 saves in the night and gets the shutout and, basically hits the max that a goalie can get in terms of fantasy points. On any given night, if you look at the goalies and their true, their final outcome for fantasy points, it's going to be basically two clusters. The goalies that did well, and they're all going to be roughly the same fantasy outcome, and then the goalies that did poorly, the ones that gave up, a ton of goals and probably didn't take as many, they didn't make as many saves because the opposing team wasn't taking as many shots. And so I agree with Scott that it's not like pitchers in baseball where every night there's going to be one or two that really run away, and if you don't have them, you're not going to win. I don't think that's as much the case with goalies in NHL. I think you can viably win with any number of two or three goalies on any night.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I mean, you can see these kind of principles here that you guys are talking about in the data, right? I mean, this 95th percentile outcomes are pretty remarkably close, down to the list here. But the average value, the point per dollar projection that maybe like a traditional tool might optimize for goalies, you can see, if you want to scroll back up here real quick for me, a guy like Sergei Bobrovsky here, right? Basically the equivalent 95th percentile outcome as all of these other goalies in the same range, but going to have way lower ownership probably just because his average point per dollar value's lower, which doesn't really matter here.
There are some people out there that just won't pay for a goalie, period, and I totally get that. Like, use that money somewhere else. Like, that makes total sense to me. But I see 5% or under, especially against a team like Washington, because Ovechkin's going to shoot. He's going to keep shooting. He's not going to stop shooting. If those pucks don't get past him, Bobrovsky's got a chance to do a 35-40 save night and do okay for himself. So I like that.
Yeah, we do have a hashtag team fade 8K goalies here in the chat. So,
and I totally get, like, that's totally valid. And I've been on that team before in the past, but I've adjusted a little bit to be more team under 10% owned is more what I like from my goalies. Can I make just one more quick observation about goalies?
Of course,
I get questions about correlation with goalies. Lots of times you'll get a question, should you stack goalies with your skaters and things like that? And there's no great right answer here, but I do want to look real quick at goalie correlation. So this is, we're looking at Bobrovsky again. So he plays for Florida. And you see, he is like, kind of mildly to low correlated with basically everybody on the Panthers, right? He's more likely than not to do well if they do well, but this is closer to what you see from like a baseball lineup, right? So hitter one in a lineup to hitter two to hitter three, et cetera. It's not the same strong correlation that you get with like line mates that are above the line. And I think some of that comes from the fact that if a team is doing particularly well, so let's say the Panthers are doing well and scoring goals to the point where Bobrovsky might win, that means one of two things is likely happening. They are turtling and not letting the other team get as many shots, so his upside gets reduced, or the other team is taking more shots and scoring more goals, which brings him down a little bit as well. So just because Barkov and Hornquist do well does not necessarily mean that Bobrovsky is automatically in the 30-point club or something like that for the night.
So definitely not a situation where you're forcing your goalies to be stacked with your stacks in your lineups.
No. I try to never do that. If it happens organically, that's fine, but I will never force it.
Gotcha. Cool. So I want to kind of move here and maybe talk about what actually the process looks like when we're building lineups on SaberSim. But before we jump into that, I want to start with a very important concept that we talk about in all of our videos, and that is contest selection. I know, especially for folks that have maybe just diving into the NHL lobby for the first time this season, going to see a little bit smaller contest than what they're used to, maybe for NBA, NFL, even baseball. And sometimes these contests don't always fit as well into some of the contest selection principles that we've talked about in other videos. What do you guys think are the best contests overall in the lobby for DraftKings and FanDuel, if you're playing there too? And what contest do you think people should focus on to have the best return?
Sam, I think you're more of a FanDuel guy, right? So maybe I'll let you take that one because I'm more DraftKings.
Yeah, I mean, on FanDuel, like, just to be totally frank, there's not that many good contests for NHL. Pretty much every night, they run like a $4.44, like 150 max. Mm-hmm. And especially for somebody that's not like grinding the high stakes, like that's probably going to be your best bet there. And then they also have like their 100 man contest, their 3 max 100 man contest. Those are always really good. But the downside, especially on FanDuel, is like they may only open 3-4 of those a day, just depending on how many people are registering them. But I think, you know, my best advice for NHL, since the contests are so sparse, like just pick the contests that fit your bankroll. If you only want to play, you know, $50 a night or $40 or whatever, then, you know, select the contests that fit that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not like NFL or MLB where you kind of can get to be picky.
I have to echo, I love those 100 man contests. I don't play a lot on FanDuel, but between baseball and hockey, those are my favorites. They are so much softer than they should be, and they're easy to take down. I really like this. That's a good call actually on those. DraftKings is similar. I mean, there's more contests on DraftKings than FanDuel, mm-hmm. but it has a similar problem, right? Where if you're used to the big, big prize pools from NFL or even from NBA, heck, even MLB, when MLB is the only game in town, you might be a little disappointed, right? You'll come in and be like, what is this that I'm looking at right now? $500 max $1 contest? I don't know what to do with this right now. but I can't agree more with the sentiment to just play what fits into your bankroll, because there's a lot of options out there. Just none of them are like the big, huge jackpot that you're going to like all of a sudden be able to like retire and become a full-time fantasy sports player because you've won it, right? There's like the normal, you know, 20 max, $1. There's the quarter, there's the dime. So plenty of contests for smaller stakes players, but they are very difficult to take down. When you talk about, you know, 7,000 or 5,000 people in a contest in a game like NHL, where you've got a ton of variance and probably more viable players on a, you know, on a slate, at least per team, than any other sport. Like all these rules we're talking about, whether it be stacking and correlation and things like that, like you're going to get taken down by a guy that managed to get like 9 of the right one-offs, right? They're just going to pick the right 9 guys who happen to have the highest score. It's going to happen, and you're going to get frustrated, and you're going to want to throw your mouse through your computer monitor because somebody managed to like hit that parlay there. But there's a lot of smaller contests too, and three entry and single entries that I personally love those mm-hmm. kinds of contests, because I think they do play a little bit softer. And as you see in other sports as well, people kind of either they hedge their bets a little bit and they play them a little bit more like cash than they probably should, or they don't put the right amount of thought on them, or they just don't embrace the variance. And the chalk is even like worse in some of those contests than, say, you know, a larger 20 entry max. And I think those are actually the area I like to focus in on. I play the 20 maxes as well, and sometimes the mini max, but those three entries and single entries, there's a $12 single entry on DraftKings every day. I love that contest. You know, I only take, you know, only take it down once, twice a year, but it's a great contest, and it's not, relative to the pool size, it's not that difficult to take it down if you follow, you know, strong build principles on the front end, and just, you know, just fade a little bit of chalk and grind it out every day. Hockey's a grind, man. It's you have to really grind away at it if you want to succeed at it. It's hard to have like immediate success and prolonged success. It's going to be frustrating sometimes, not just because of the contests, but because of how variant it is.
Right. Yeah. Those high variant sports can kind of just be that way sometimes. I feel the exact same way about baseball. You're on a bad streak in the middle of the summer. It's like, how does anybody win at this?
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, no. And I think those are good points. In a sport where the contests are going to be smaller too, one of the things I always say here on Office Hours is, and I think Sam, you kind of touched on it, don't be afraid to scale back a little bit. You know, you can get a ton of action down in just amazing contests, any NFL Sunday and even a big NBA slate. It's very easy to just find all those best contests and get a ton of volume down. I recorded a video the other day talking about NBA contest selection, and it was very easy to get like a few thousand dollars down even in fantastic NBA contests between the two sites. If you're playing hockey, you're interested in trying it out even, just scale that bankroll back a little bit and play some of these great contests that you guys were talking about. Maybe focus a little bit more on those single entry and three max there too. I know this is a question that I will inevitably get here, so want to just chat about it here while we're talking about contest selection. But NHL cash games, any value there?
Negative value.
Yeah, yeah. If you're the person who has figured out the code to NHL cash, I would love to talk to you and find out your advice. I would never recommend NHL cash to anyone for some of the reasons that we mentioned before. If someone's looking for cash advice, I mean, I think a lot of the rules we're talking about still apply. Like, correlation doesn't go away because you're playing cash, right? Like, if I'm playing Austin Matthews, I want probably two other guys that he's on the ice with all the time, right? But I'm just playing a ton of, you know, tonight probably trying to get Toronto and I don't know, Pittsburgh maybe, or I don't know who else is on the ownership line tonight, but and I'm probably trying to get Vasilevsky or somebody like that in my lineup, like, just to, you're playing ownership at that point, right? But so the rules still apply. But it's just, it's so variant. You saw what we were looking at with Matthews before. There's no way to guarantee he's going to hit that projection. So you're really just throwing darts and hoping for the best.
Gotcha. Yeah. And another contest type that I do get questions about here sometimes are showdowns. Do you guys play any showdowns? Do you think those are viable contests at all? I know in higher variant sports, I think those can be the sports where SaberSim in particular does excel a little bit more at building showdown lineups.
I don't play them.
I can speak to him a little bit. I totally like SaberSim is great for NHL showdowns, just like it is for MLB showdowns. There's just not a lot of them is the problem. So I don't play a lot because there's just not a lot of great value or volume there. But, you know, looking at the way SaberSim like literally sims the games and you just jack up that variant slider. And again, you kind of look for areas where correlation will still be impacted, right? Like I probably wouldn't want six guys all from six different lines in my showdown lineup, right? But the same rules apply. Those guys who are all on the ice at the same time are going to be on the ice at the same time. But I, for a showdown, I kind of just let SaberSim take the wheel and just kind of do a spot check of the lineups to make sure there's nothing too crazy going on. To Sam's point before, one of the two goalies is probably going to be among the top four or five scorers in the game, if not the top scorer. The other one will probably not be. Again, sometimes that changes, but that's just it's kind of 50-50 on that, right? But yeah, SaberSim is great if you just kind of let it do its thing for showdowns. I don't have a process for them. I kind of just let it do its thing and then kind of pull some random lineups from the pool and throw them into showdowns.
Gotcha. Yeah, and no, I mean, I think it's important to mention too that when you say SaberSim is doing its thing, the thing that is happening there is pretty sophisticated, and that's why there's so much value there in the lineups, right? The lineups that you're seeing, if you're going to be building NHL Showdown lineups with SaberSim, are going to be optimals for a certain game simulation, a certain game script, a game outcome we have. So, you know, you're not being left with trying to come up with what that game script looks like yourself and then trying to build the optimal lineup that fits it. It's all kind of happening together all at once. So, but yeah, I did a quick pass through the lobby as well. It doesn't seem like there is a lot of contests there out there to play on the NHL mm-hmm. Showdown apartment. But anyway, I think maybe a good opportunity to kind of just go through and step through a build here and see what actually building lineups looks like on SaberSim here. You know, starting with step one, depending on the sport, I maybe do a little bit more here, maybe do a little bit less. In terms of, I think in particular, what people are most interested in on step one is this player pool curation side of things. Do you guys find that that's a part of the process that you're doing often, removing players from the pool, kind of prioritizing what the lineups are going to start to look like here in step one already, or generally leaving things more wide open?
I generally don't remove anybody with one exception. In NHL specifically, I mean, a lot of sports have this problem, but it's a real bad problem in NHL of just like scarcity of information. And so if there is like a questionable player, especially in one of the earliest games, mm-hmm. And I think that that player is like fairly inconsequential, I might remove them just to, you know, not risk having a dead lineup if that guy lands up in there somehow. But most nights I won't do that. Yeah,
same. The only things I will sometimes, you know, remove is if there's like a super chalk goalie, I may either reduce him or remove him entirely just to build lineups without him in there, just because, like we talked about with goalies before, I don't want to be on the chalk with the goalie. But I'm not going to pretend that I know more about SaberSim and change any of these projections or anything like that. And I probably could go through and maybe remove fourth line players who I know I probably don't want, but when you get them in your build, SaberSim is giving you them for a reason, right? So I at least like to consider those lines before I remove them outright at the next step. So I'm not really changing much here. I'm really just using this step to give me like the lay of the land for the slate, right? Like, where's the chalk sitting? Who's got the high ceilings tonight? Kind of, you know, also it's a great way to curate like information, the latest information about the lines in case something's change that I wasn't even aware of to see like who's skating together. But this is more just information curation that I'm kind of sticking in the back of my head rather than changing a whole lot at this stage.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Let's jump to step two here and talk about the build settings a bit. I see you've already got some settings here loaded in,
I think these were the default 20 max. I think these are the default settings for today. Let me just double check real quick. Yeah, those are the default settings. So I do not typically use the default settings. I will admit that right off the bat. But these default settings are totally fine. Like I don't think there's any problem if you were to just go right in and just use these right off the bat. They're the defaults for a reason, right? I don't think you need to use these defaults with stacking rules, which I just generated some quick lineups to enter my contest today. So mm-hmm. we'll talk about that in a second. But what I'm coming in here, when I love high variance, like I will almost always jack this up to 10. Like, mm-hmm. and I know that's scary for some people because you will get players in your lineups who look like they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn with a slap shot. It's going to happen sometimes. And I think that's okay. But along with that, what I will do, this comes way down because I'm going to do my own stacking rules usually as well. I trust SaberSim to do it, but I know that I want players from the same even strength or power play lines. Like, I know that I do. So I'm just going to go tell it, I want players from the same power play line and from the same even strength line. Now, does it have to be 4 power play and 3 even strength? Not necessarily. No, there are some, there's some slates where, you know, maybe there's not an obvious like best power play play, and I'll just go 3-3. So even strength straight through. Right. But for tonight, with some of these teams we've got on the slate, I know I'm going to build around the power play, because you saw that's where all of the upside is tonight, is in power play line. So I'm sticking with that, especially because there's so many players tonight who are like offline power play players. So they play on line two or three, but are also on the power play. So that's why I like thought about that tonight. But I am basically every slate setting my own stacking rules to make sure I get players who are from the same line playing with one another, because they are so strongly correlated with one another. And then I'll usually drop ownership fade as well, because Sim Variance does a good job of getting players that are like on the lower ownership scale. And I don't want to go so far to this side that I'm only getting like, you know, 1% owned, like very high variance players. But there's no like rule here. This is just kind of 2-2-10 for me is kind of where I've settled, but I've seen plenty of other choices within here that still work. Sam, anything you want to add to what you'd kind of do in here? Cause I know everybody has a different philosophy here.
No, I mean, I pretty similarly sometimes will add some stacking rules if I think that that's, you know, worth it for the night. The major thing that I do is I will change the min salary down a bit. Mm-hmm. Just because if you are using these default settings, most of the time you're just going to get like, yep, even strength one combinations. And then when you drop it down, like you will get ones and twos and ones and threes and whatever.
That's a really good point, actually. That's also something I will often do. Again, slate size dependent, smaller slate, this goes way down. Bigger slate, maybe I keep it up just so I make sure that I get, so I'm not like naturally handcuffing myself and like getting worse defensemen, for instance, than I probably should be taking for my lineup. But that's a really good point.
Yeah, and one question just I'm curious about too, because I on sports where I set a manual stacking rule, I take the opposite approach. I'm curious if you've run builds where you've both set the manual stacking rule and also leave the correlation at the high or very high value, and if there's kind of like a reason or what your thought process was in ultimately bringing that correlation slider down after setting the stacking rule.
So for me, because I've based like, so this particular build is basically the entire, like this covers all your stacks here, right? I don't need any additional correlation on top of this, because this is going to get me a defenseman who is naturally correlated with the other three skaters. Like that's because it has to basically to do this. It's not, gotcha, not a definite, but it's almost always going to do that. If I go with like a 3-3, or I only like, let's get rid of this one, and I only run like a single rule to make sure I get at least three from the same line in a lineup, mm-hmm, then in that case, I will bring this up quite a bit to let the rest of the lineup fill out. But I know on a slate like tonight, I want to make sure that I'm taking advantage of the correlation that every single one of these teams is going to have, because yeah, it is such a big, it's a larger slate. It's on the large side for NHL. So I don't want to leave anything to chance on a night like tonight. But if this were a smaller slate, or maybe there were some teams that, you know, some teams that I didn't think had as high upside, maybe I would, you know, leave it more to chance, like I just showed there. That's really where that decision for me comes from. And the correlation slider related to the stacking rules is really to get that defenseman who is right, correlated with the line, because this even strength line here, this will only give you forwards. This will not actually give you defensemen who are also on line one, because they're not technically on the same even strength line. So this will give me a center and two wings, but no defensemen. This will ensure that sometimes in some of my lineups, I get the defenseman that's correlated with those players also.
Got it. Makes sense. So these stacking rules that you set then tend to be pretty varied based on what the individual slate looks like in terms, yeah, of size and context overall.
Yeah. Especially again, I'm going to just cancel here real quick.
Yeah. No
as
problem.
We were looking at this before, we saw like just all of the top projections tonight for skaters are, you know, these guys who are on the power play, right? Like it's just, because it's such a large slate, it's, mm-hmm, just all these guys are the guys with the highest upside. So there's just so many options here that I'm going to try to embrace that tonight, because there's just so many of them to go with tonight. On a smaller slate, these options probably change quite a bit. But these are the ones who tonight are I would be shocked if most of the top 10 scorers don't come from power play lines on a night like tonight.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah. And I think for somebody, I'm thinking about this for me, maybe somebody that's very new to NHL, without that sense of intuition here with what maybe a slate looks like, I think the correlation slider is probably a better approach than setting these stacking rules and turning it down, just to let the natural correlation from the Sims kind of help guide you to those right kind of stacking rules. But definitely a kind of resourceful idea here of sorting by projection, or even sorting maybe by some of the ceiling percentiles, and kind of seeing what lines those players skate on as a way to set these stacking rules. But anything else that you guys want to touch about the build settings here before we go ahead and start building some lineups and seeing what we look like on step three?
I get questions about skaters versus opposing goalies sometimes. I just want to bring that up real quick. Mm-hmm. Except on like a 2-game slate or maybe a 3-game slate where all the teams stink, I would never, ever, ever check this off. But 2-game slates, it's super valid, super valuable. But you are introducing so many chances for unforced errors and riskier. There's like a narrow pipeline you can see, or like one team's first line takes like 18 shots but doesn't score, and the and you have the opposing goalie where both of those are the right play. Like, it's possible, but it is so unlikely. You're introducing so much risk that it's more risk than I would be willing to take. So I almost never, in any case, except like I said, those smallest of small slates, or like a showdown, obviously. But on the smallest of small slates, would I do that?
Yeah, and I think that will be checked on by default only for those very small slates. I would imagine maybe 3 games or less.
I know it's 2. I think you're right, 3. And then after 4 and above, it goes off.
Gotcha. Cool. Okay.
Want to build?
Yeah, let's build some lineups.
All right. I'm just going with Saber Sim defaults right now, because I think this will actually tell a really good story for us.
Perfect. Yeah. And while this is building, I always like to use this opportunity, especially for people that, again, maybe aren't as familiar with the Saber Sim method here. You saw we selected a 20 max contest, 10 to 50K entrance. We asked for 20 lineups, but you can see what's happening here is we're building 500. The reason for that is we're going to build this nice big pool of what we feel are viable lineups for the contest, but allow us to edit exposures, dial things in, quality control our lineups without having to build anything extra here, all in step three. So we'll let this build wrap up here, and we'll kind of start talking about the way we do that. I know, first of all, there have been quite a few questions that have rolled in here in chat. We'll get through kind of the end of our little test build here, and then we'll start answering some questions for you guys. Thanks for everybody that's already asked some questions. So
my favorite way to approach the 2 changes to unlock lineups for NHL, I love 95th percentile. It's my favorite. I mean, you don't have to go that high. Mm-hmm. 75th percentile will do it also. I do the same thing for baseball. I will use 90 and above for the percentile. Again, looking at that upside in the lineups rather than just pure projection. So that's my trick to getting. You don't have to go and edit any individual players. Just go with that higher percentile for NHL.
Yeah, that is definitely a good way to do it here. I think the way I ultimately end up getting that message away is through the process of editing my exposures. And I think, I mean, one thing I just immediately noticed, and it makes sense, is that when you switch to 95th percentile, our top exposures for our lineups all went down a little bit. Calling back to the fact that the ceilings of these players are actually pretty similar, even if their average projections are not. But let's talk about the exposures a little bit here. One of the things I always recommend people do in step three for any sport is think about their risk and try to manage their risk in a way that kind of fits the way that you want to approach the contest. What are you guys normally thinking about with your exposures here overall? How condensed do you like to be on these exposures to certain players, certain stacks, things like that? Does it vary significantly based on the contest you're playing? Just curious kind of what you guys think about here as soon as you hit step three.
So I don't approach it purely from just like adjusting exposures.
Okay.
What I like to do first is actually like I'll just push away the actual players and just look at the lineups. Mm-hmm. And it's not so I also can't see it very clearly, but it doesn't look like the lineups are like super condensed. Like on some nights you can see like the same group of 4 players are all in the same, you know, top 10 lines. And I'll just start kind of manually curating, like, oh, I don't necessarily want to be overexposed to this combination of players.
Yeah.
I just want maybe the best one of that. And as I do that, the exposures will kind of naturally adjust.
Yeah, I'll say I probably go to the very far extreme on this. I will literally start with a single lineup. I'll adjust it down to one. Now, again, this is total insanity, and I would not recommend everybody do with this. But to give you an idea of how I'm thinking about this and why I'm doing it the way I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. So we see this is the first lineup we've got here, and maybe I'll look at some of the other players to see like who I don't yet have in this lineup. So let's take, I don't know, who's somebody who is going to do well but is low-owned. Let's take... We don't even have to be low on. Let's just go with Ovechkin, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to look at all of the Ovechkin lineups I have in my pool, right? Because I know he's somebody I probably want some exposure to, especially at only 10% owned, because he is a high ceiling kind of player. You see here his ceiling projection is 31 points. That's pretty good. You're gonna do well most nights if you have a couple players in the 30s.
Yeah.
So I look through here. We've got a few lines with Ovechkin kind of one-off around some of these other players. That's probably not what I'm looking for. So who is he on the same line with? He is on the same line as players like where is our boy looking for line one for Washington. So Kuznetsov is on the same line with him. So maybe I'll grab a Kuznetsov also to isolate those lineups where Ovechkin and Kuznetsov are in the same line together and start to see, okay, so we've got a Capitals Vegas lineup here. So maybe grab some of that, but I don't want all of my Capitals lineups to be Vegas lineups. So we got Capitals Bruins. I'm literally going to go through and manually make sure I've got exposure to all sorts of different other lines with Alex Ovechkin, and not just first lines either. Like I want to look at some of the higher performing second lines,
yeah,
some of the higher performing third lines, because that's where you're going to get a lot of the ownership leverage as well, right? In those second and third lines that might also allow you to get some good defensemen in your lineups. So I am like, I'm insane. And I know that I'm insane about that. There are ways you can get to this without doing it one by one, like I will do on nights where I have time. Uh-huh. One of the other things that I really like to do when I have, if I don't have quite as much time, is I'll do it at a team by team level, right? So let's say I have 40 lineups I need to fill for tonight. So let's change this to 40. I will take a look here. Maybe I'll start by just trying to introduce some of these other teams to my pool, right? So let's get, you know, a couple of Tampa Bay lineups in here. Let's get a couple of Detroit lineups in here. I want to have a little bit of as many of the teams as I can because of the variance of the sport. Mm-hmm. I don't love to be overweight on anybody. I will never land on 62% Boston at the end of the time. I get why Boston's way up there from an ownership and upside perspective. They probably should be way up there. But I definitely don't want, you know, all these Boston Pittsburgh lineups. If I'm going to have that much Boston, I want Boston with everybody, right? And then I want Pittsburgh with everybody, or as many everybody's as I can get. So I'm going to spend the time to do that. You can obviously do this much faster by just doing line by line exposure if you're in a hurry, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I will actually go through like almost on a player by player level to make sure that I get great combinations of second and third level kind of variance in my lineups. I want those exposures to be as spread as they can be, because I'm trying to take down one contest. I'm not trying to get, you know, 30 lineups across the line. I'm trying to take down one of my contests, and that's what I'm gunning for. So again, I know this isn't for everybody, like that level of insanity, but I will often, when I have the time, I will actually go through and manually select my lineups from the pool based on the exposures that they allow me.
Gotcha. Yeah, no. And Max was on here the other day talking about, honestly, a very similar approach to the way that he's been doing some of his NFL showdown lineups, also very high variance of kind of letting those exposures come to you naturally by going through your pool and finding those lineups that look right, that have kind of maybe a particular set of combinations of players that you're looking for, or anything like that, rather than directly engaging with the exposures, the Minimax exposures here, like might be the more traditional approach here. Curious, you know, in particular, because we didn't set a stacking rule here, we just let correlations kind of guide us. Anything that you like to look at in particular stack types, prioritizing certain combinations of stacks or eliminating certain combinations of stacks?
Sam, you want to take this one first?
I do my best to trust the sim in most situations. I think, like, if I had a personal preference, like, I would usually avoid like 5 and 6 stacks. But you can even see, like, they show up so infrequently that it's pretty likely that whatever that lineup is does have a viable outcome. I just don't think it happens often enough for me to want to roster it. But for the most part, I don't limit it. I just kind of let the builder give me what it thinks is viable.
Yeah, and ultimately, I agree with it. I will almost never, again, dependent on slate size and who we're talking about here, almost never run a 5 or a 6 stack, just because it's a level of risk I'm not comfortable with. But also, like, let's just take Lindholm as an example. There's not really 5 or 6 players that he's highly correlated with, right? There's Johnny Gaudreau, which makes sense because they skate together. There's Matthew Tkachuk, they skate together. But as you get, and then there's Rasmus Anderson, who's a defenseman. But as you get further down, like, he doesn't really have 6 players that he's highly correlated with. And one of them is even like the next, like, the 6th player is a Dallas defenseman, right?
Yeah.
So you're really, what a 6 stack is really saying is there are 2 independently correlated lines from the same team that we are banking on doing well, which again is just, it's not particularly likely that 2 lines from the same team are going to, like, be in the jackpot, right? Because it'll happen. Like, I've seen, like, a night where the Sidney Crosby line and the Guentzel line from Pittsburgh just go off and they score like 9 goals. Like, that's happened before, right? But it's not that, it's just so uncommon that you're actually adding so much risk by including them that I try to avoid them. Again, we're just playing a correlation game here. 3 and 4 is really the most number of guys who are really that strongly correlated with one another. So that's what I'm focusing on here. And especially looking at some of those 3 stacks where it's, you know, maybe a second line or a third line to go along with a really high, you know, really strong first line. But yeah, 3 and 4 stacks are the ones that make the most sense to me. 3-2-2 is fine also.
Gotcha. So again, yeah, maybe for somebody without as much of an intuitive sense of what the right stacking rules are for the right slate, a good approach here would be let that correlation slider guide you, but maybe do a little bit of trimming of some of those really big stacks here in step 3, 5 and 6 stacks, especially I imagine on a bigger slate, even more important to kind of trim some of the fat there.
Yep.
I know we are, an hour has gone fast on us, starting to get a little close on time here. So I want to hit some questions real quick. From YouTube chat and from Slack. I just lost my question here. I wanted to pull up this first one. This was from Tim. He said, do the Sims utilize line matching data from each team in any fashion? I'm not exactly so sure what line matching is referring to here. Unless you guys have a sense here, I may need to go back to the rest of the team and ask them. But
so I don't know if the Sims take it into account. I don't think I've ever asked Matt about it, but what he's talking about is how there are some coaches who won't match their first line with the other first line, right? So they'll match like their third line or a more physical line with other team's like best scoring line, which then in turn means that team's more physical lines who are not the higher upside ones are getting more time on ice because of who they're going up against. And thus, like we talked about before, the more time on ice is the more opportunity to score more points, right? And this is actually a pretty big thing that there are some coaches that will do that. I just don't know how much the sim, obviously that's a question.
Yeah, so Matt, I think. Yeah, well, and I would say my impression here, I'll go back and I'll talk to Matt and the guys about this. My impression here is that this is probably something that the Sims don't really rigorously take into account, and it is a great spot to add value if you've got a sense of how a coach is going to do that. I mean, it sounds similar to something like NBA, where maybe a coach is going to use a different rotation against a certain team that maybe likes to play small or something like that. I'm way bigger on the NBA side, so that's just where my head goes. That's another good spot to add value there. If you have a sense of where that rotation might be different, especially compared to how it typically looks, I think a good spot to make some adjustments here. So A couple other questions here that came in, and this I think came back mostly when we were talking about ownership earlier, but Don said, do you think the field overvalues power play points considering the small amount of the time they're actually on power play? Related to that, how often do power point two players actually get in on the power play in any given game? Curious your guys' thoughts on that, especially thinking earlier here about the emphasis on the power play lines that we were talking about before.
So I don't know if you want to take this one first, Sam. As you know, I have opinions on all this stuff, but
yeah, I mean, for me, I don't, I don't like overweight or like overemphasize the need for power play correlation in my lineups. I figured the builder is taking that into account, to a level that I like. So I don't put much consideration into it. I just let the builder handle that.
From my standpoint, I agree with the premise of this question, actually, because power play time is not, you can't really predict it. You can like try to predict it based on the team they're playing against, right? But you don't know going in that a team is going to spend 8 minutes on the power play or something like that. Yes, if a team is on the power play, they are much more likely to score than on even strength, right? So that is something that we take into account. But he's right. The field knows this also. And the power play one guys are always going to be very highly owned as a result because their scoring opportunities just go through the roof, right? What you saw from me before where I actually had four power play guys is not, it's actually not a common build that I use. Mm-hmm. I did that for my initial kind of default lineups today just to kind of get stuff in. But I actually like to focus on the even strength lineups as kind of and build around those and fill in with the power play lines because I think even strength is where you can be a lot more predictable in who's going to be on the ice together and when yeah. and how much time they're going to spend. Like if you go through a 60-minute game, you know that the first line is going to spend about 18 minutes on the ice with each other, and the second line will spend 16 or so minutes. Again, it changes a little bit per team, but so you know that you're going to get that 16 minutes of ice time for your second line and you know 15 to 16 for your third line, and that's predictable. You know you're going to get that, and the field. I think the field undervalues that from a second and third line, for sure. Mm-hmm. Answering if they overvalue power play is a little bit more difficult, but I think there's some validity to that statement. And I'll also say to his question about power play two, I don't really target power play two at all because the time they get in most often is towards the end of a long power play. Mm-hmm. Or you know, it's even less predictable than power play one. So it's good to know who might have a little bit of extra scoring opportunity. But yeah, power play two is even less predictable than power play one. So I would not target that at all.
Gotcha. Cool. Brian had a quick question here as well, and I think this plays in a lot more to thinking about our exposures of our lineups in step three. But he said, what do you do when you're targeting a line and you plan to play a lot of them, but SaberSim is also giving you the opposing goalie in your other lineups? Just cross off the goalie. Broadly speaking, you know, if a certain line or a certain team stack is one of your favorite teams on the night, how do you think about exposure to the goalie on the other side, even in other lineups, right? Obviously not combining these two together in the same lineup, but is this something you intentionally try to remove to kind of create some inter-lineup correlation here, or just kind of roll with the punches of what you're getting out of the optimizer?
I was going to say, it sounds like Brian's hedging his bets, and that sounds smart to me. No, I think I mentioned this before. I actually don't spend a lot of time thinking about goalies, and I don't mean mm-hmm. that like in a negative way, like, oh, goalies don't matter, I don't think about them. But I think that's where I'll just let SaberSim tell me who the best goalie to play for the rest of the lineup is. Because I care about the guys who are on the ice trying to score goals, right? Goalies are so difficult to predict mm-hmm. that I trust the sim way more than I trust my own ability to predict what a goalie is going to do. So in that regard, I probably wouldn't cross one off again, except in the case where someone just feels so overowned relative to how many goalies are on the slate. I might cross them off for ownership reasons, not because I have so much of the other team.
Yeah, and a similar question. I've got a similar question on office hours here before. And again, I think this is a little bit more on the side of like your personal risk versus upside equation here. Obviously, kind of creating that inter-lineup correlation, you are not going to increase the expected value of a lineup that has a certain stack because in another lineup, you remove the goalie playing against that stack. But you do maybe create a little bit higher upside overall correlating those lineups together, where you also stand to increase your risk. So I think that's kind of the way I like to think about this a lot. I think probably for a high variance sport like hockey, you know, does make sense to maybe hedge a little bit more, or at least allow that option to show up if they're showing up in your lineups. Let's see. Let's keep it rolling here. A bunch of questions, which is awesome here. There was a question here from Phantom. This came in Slack here ahead of time for the show. But he said, best way to select what position you want for your utility spot. Does this come into play at all for you guys? Are you thinking about targeting a particular player in utility at all? Certain position, anything like that?
For me, I don't. I know a lot of people have different opinions about, you know, what position goes there. I just kind of let the builder, like, I'm assuming that they're putting that player there for a reason, whether it's just that you're getting additional correlation and it fits salary wise or whatever, but I don't like remove players from the util slot for the most part.
Yeah, I think naturally you're going to get players there that, you know, again, looking at how I might build like a typical 3-3-2 or 4-3 lineup, that's how just most of my lineups end up shaking out. That utility spot will end up being used on someone who correlates well to some other skaters in my lineup, right? I think there's a misconception out there also that you wouldn't want to play like a defenseman in your utility spot, which I don't think I end up with a lot of defensemen there, but there's a lot of like high ceiling defensemen, and defensemen are among the highest scorers on the slate. You know, it's hard to predict who they're going to be, but you can get a lot of really strong defense scores in that utility spot. So if the crux of the question is like eliminating defensemen, like I probably wouldn't play like a cheap defenseman just to fill out the rest of the lineup there intentionally, maybe unintentionally I would, but really the player I want there is someone who correlates well to the other players in my lineup. I know I keep coming back to correlation, but I want someone who's going to correlate well to the other players because you want to raise that floor of your lineup more and more with every correlated player.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times on these rules of thumbs about utility spots in general that you see on a variety of sports, you know, you hear it a lot in NFL too, come from the fact that traditional tools don't deal with that problem very well and will just pack a very good point per dollar play into the lineup, which doesn't necessarily make your lineup have higher upside. It doesn't necessarily mean that player's correlated. They may not have strong individual upside. With SaberSim here, if you're getting a player in the utility spot like a defenseman or something like that, if your sliders are set at what the approximate defaults are, you're probably getting a player that is showing up in that lineup for a reason. Maybe they have high upside compared to their ownership, or they otherwise correlate to the correlate otherwise to the rest of the lineup, similar to like the two tight ends thing in football, right? People always want to avoid those two tight ends, but you're going to see that if that lineup shows up in your pool of lineups, it's there for a reason. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to, let's grab a couple other questions here. First of all, B Crimson had a good question here, came in Slack here, and he said, what is your single entry strategy? And this is another question that comes in office hours all the time. And I know sometimes the answer to this question is it's very similar to what I do when I'm building 20 lineups. But if you were building just a single lineup for an NHL slate, is there anything that you would do a little bit differently here to get from, you know, building maybe this pool of lineups to what that final lineup is going to look like?
My original answer was going to be, well, I just randomly pick one of my lineups and that's what goes in the single entry. But if I'm just building one lineup, I need to think about that. I don't know if you already have an answer for this, Sam. I need to think about this for a second.
Well, so yeah, I don't build it any differently than I would for, you know, 20 entries. But so a lot of my like foundational DFS concepts came from single entry in 3-max. Like that's really where I started. I think a lot of people start there as well. But as I scaled up to like 20 entries, my goal was that every single one of those 20, I could look at them and have like a high amount of confidence that like, oh, I'm proud of this lineup. I like it because of this factor or this factor. And so I don't really do anything different for single entry. I think you can kind of just look at the lineups and be like, well, I don't want a bunch of these like super low owned guys that have super low projections. 'Cause like, like I said before, that means that they probably have low opportunity for points as well. You could certainly still take down a single entry contest that way, but like I don't think you need to add like the unnecessary like max amount of risk for single entry. So yeah, I mean, I don't really do anything different, which is not a great answer, but I do kind of like curate my lineups and I make sure that, you know, the one that I pick for a single entry is one that that I like for one reason or another, whether it's like a combination of two lineups or that I like or something.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to that is if I'm building just one lineup, yeah, my process probably won't change very much, but I'll almost certainly pick one that is on the lower end of the scale from an ownership perspective, right? Like I'll want to grab the one that is not full of chalk. You know, maybe the top one from a Sabre score perspective that doesn't, like tonight's a great example that has neither Matthews or Bergeron in it, like something like that, right? Just because if I'm going for that one single bullet, I'm going to play the risk reward game, right? And that's one where I want to take the biggest risk for potentially the biggest reward. But in terms of overall process, yeah, I agree. I probably wouldn't change much.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I talk about this sometimes here. You know, when you're building a lineup for a single entry and you go in and change your sliders, the factors, the individual weights of correlation and ownership and variance are going to change. A lot of those are going to go down a little bit, but you're still building a lineup with the same tool, taking into account the same factors. So I don't think in general, really for almost any sport, that your single entry process needs to be remarkably different than what you would do for multi-entry. But definitely a good question there. There are a couple questions here about the research process overall. And I know we touched on it a little bit here when we were looking at step one, but I figure maybe wrap around here again at the end. James said, could you go over some KPIs to look at or other suggestions to find some of these high upside options? Anything that you guys look into? Phantom asked a question about running research builds, which is kind of something that I like to do. I like to run builds on really high variance before I even start building anything, just to kind of see what players' chance of being optimal is. Is there anything that you guys do? And again, I know we touched on a little bit at the beginning, but anything else you guys do just to get an idea of what the slate looks like when you're doing your research, maybe coming up with some targets, particularly maybe for somebody that doesn't know the NHL as intuitively, anything that you would recommend somebody go off and look into in their research process before they start building lineups?
So one thing I like to do sometimes is I'll look at the entire pool that Sabre Sim has given me and compare that to a couple, like to see, okay, it exposed me this much to Bergeron relative to what his ownership was going to be, right? Just to, again, give me some ideas about like where Sabre Sim wants me to be heavier on somebody than maybe the field would otherwise be. I know 500 is still a relatively small sample of lineups, but just to kind of give me that taste of, okay, this is where we're at. This is who it likes relative to where the field might like that person. So you see some of these Boston guys are even higher than their already high ownership, including McAvoy here. So that's one area I might do some of that. But again, I actually rely on the Sims a ton for the actual research itself, just because I think the data we get out of like what we're running here is just as good as anything I'm going to mine myself on in other areas. I think the test builds are a great idea. You know, back testing, I know there's different people who feel different things about back testing. I think that's fine to get an idea of what lineups look like and kind of look at them, you know, after the fact. I think that's really useful as well. You can see kind of correlation in play there, how the guys who score 25 or 30 points often have guys that trail them with, you know, 15 or so on the same teams. You can actually see some of that in practice rather than in theory. But like, there's just not a lot of extra research I'm doing because SaberSim does so much of it for me.
Gotcha. Awesome.
Yeah, I also do pretty minimal research. I think the builder does a really good job of taking into everything that I would do on my own with a lot less effort on my part. So.
Yeah, and that, to be completely honest, that is also my approach for other sports as well. So I can completely relate to that. A lot of my research process for NFL and baseball and things like that end up being all within SaberSim anyway, running these builds. Scott, I do almost the exact same thing that you're talking about here of seeing what that entire pool looks like and comparing your exposures to ownership early on just to see maybe where there are some leverage opportunities. But I think, you know, we're getting a little bit long on time here. Maybe start to think about wrapping it up here. I will ask maybe one more question of the both of you guys right before we kind of leave. If there is one thing that you could offer to somebody that was maybe going to be going into building their first NHL lineups tonight or this week, what do you think is the best place that that person can add value to the SaberSim process here building hockey lineups?
I cannot stress enough to spend time really getting familiar with how correlation impacts hockey. Like, I think this, like this illustration here, I think is fantastic to really show somebody like what it means to be core, like how correlation here is so different than correlation in other sports. Like, it is highly correlated, but also like very tightly and narrowly correlated, right? Like, Bergeron is correlated to like three or four of his teammates and then no one else. Well, the other goalie, right? He's negatively correlated to the other goalie as well. Mm-hmm. But he's basically, it's four players and his own goalie to a lesser extent and then no one else. And I think this really helps to like really just spending time getting familiar with how individual players, how they correlate and how they're what the range of outcomes looks like helps you understand and embrace the variance a lot more. So I think that's the one thing I would say as a point of advice.
Yeah, the only thing I would like really add to that is like don't be afraid to play a lineup that has maybe a lower projected score. You know, like I said, the projection is really just a metric of opportunity and and if a lineup is projected at like 236 versus another one at 235, I would roughly compare them pretty evenly and look for other factors that I like, such as correlation.
Awesome. Yeah, great advice all the way through the show. Thank you guys both for being on here today. This was massively eye-opening for me as somebody that just hasn't played a lot of NHL DFS. I hope it was for everybody watching here as well. If you guys have more questions after having watched this, maybe you watched the recording here and have some additional thoughts, always feel free to shout those out into either the Office Hours channel in Slack or the NHL channel. Let's get some excitement going in the NHL channel. I know Scott and Sam, I see you guys in there regularly, but if you guys have some questions, go ahead and fire them off in there. If you are watching this and haven't had an opportunity to try out SaberSim yet, we've got a free 7-day trial, no strings attached. You can check it out completely for free on our site, sabersim.com. But for now, we'll leave it there. Scott, Sam, thank you a bunch for being on here and good luck in your hockey season.
Thank you. And I look forward to you taking us down in these contests now that you know everything you need to know about hockey.
Yeah, I have more or less mastered it here. I expect to take everything down tonight, actually.
Awesome. Well, I'll see you there.
Yeah, cool. See you guys. Jordan.
Thanks.